there are spaces. And yeah, and maybe raise your hand if, because it is pretty full, if there's an empty seat near you, so people coming in. So, yeah. Well, oh, wait a minute. Okay, I have to be introduced.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to introduce you to Jack Kornfield.
Good morning. I am not Jack. My name is Romy. I'm so happy to see all of you. I'm going to give some announcements, and then Jack is going to introduce our special guest. So first of all, welcome this morning to a very special day with Peter here at Spirit Rock. This is a benefit for both entities, Spirit Rock and Peter Levine. Now, how many are new to Spirit Rock and are here? Wow, to see Peter. Okay, so these announcements are mainly for you. I'm going to go quickly because a lot of us know them. First of all, there's some teachers here. Next, moving on.
There are a lot of our teachers here, including a whole number who are in training.
There are a lot of our teachers here, including a whole number that are in training. I see many of our teachers, and I'm so happy to see everybody. CEs, continuing education credits. 54 of you wanted CE credit. If you did not sign in with your name this morning, I'm going to ask you to do that right now. Don't forget to sign out at end of day. You'll give us your survey. We'll give you your certificate. It's now time to completely turn off our cell phones. Completely. It's so lovely to turn them off for the day completely.
You're looking at me.
You'd be surprised how many teachers. We have assisted hearing devices in the back of the room with my coworker, Kevin. If you would like one, please feel free to pick one up. You are welcome to drink in the room. I see all of you have covered teacups. That's lovely. We have tea and snacks for sale in the tea area. We have our bookstore open today with many, many, many of Peter's books. Please feel free to go into the bookstore. At lunchtime, it's a glorious day. You're welcome to eat outside. There's picnic benches where the old building used to be in the meadow over there. Here's something that's new. It's a new announcement. It's tick season. So when you come back into the building, if you wouldn't mind mindfully dusting off the bottom of around your shoes, that's really lovely. If you did not bring lunch today, I'll give you directions to Woodacre Deli, which is just across Sir Francis Drake. We will be ringing, bless you. We will be ringing bells for you to come back into the room. So when you hear the bells, you can come in. We have another event upstairs today, yoga. So you may want to stay downstairs today. The restrooms are at the end of the hall, up just to the right of the bookstore. The final thing is we do have a retreat, a silent residential retreat at the upper area. So you're welcome to walk up the hill on the road. There's the gratitude hut to the left. You're welcome to go in there. But if you go any further, there's a wood gate, and it says, please do not pass. We'd love for you to respect that today because we have a 10-day retreat, two of them, at the top of the hill. Okay. Whew. Here's Jack.
Thanks, Rami. So it's a great pleasure to introduce my dear friend Peter, and also I'm really happy that you came, Peter, to Spirit Rock, and for all of the folks who've come today. In my own training as a psychologist, and over a lot of decades of being in the field, one of the things that was most striking was that there was really very little teaching about trauma. For psychiatrists and psychologists and so forth. And yet half of what walks in the door, if not more, is people who are dealing with their trauma. And then periodically somebody comes along in the field who's really a revolutionary, the way that Wilhelm Reich was in reminding people after Freud that they had bodies, for example. Although, in Peter's case, I don't think you need to do prison time to, you know, as Reich had to do to uphold your standard. But Peter's really been a revolutionary and in spelling out and in articulating both the whole range of traumas that happen to people, the neuroscience and the biology of trauma, and then developing, as you'll hear, a whole skillful set of tools that I believe have really revolutionized mental health in the country and in the world. And I'll just add to that over several decades of training teachers, in these decades, especially in the last few decades, I've encouraged, if not insisted, that meditation teachers, many of whom are here in the room, do some of this training in somatic experiencing, because what happens as people sit in meditation and get quiet is the unfinished business of the heart and of their life comes up, and often it's trauma. So there's a very compelling and beautiful wedding of the work that Peter does and will present, which is really a kind of paired mindfulness of what's going on in the body and heart and mind with the trainings that we've been doing here. And so it's with great gratitude and appreciation I welcome you.
Thank you, Jack.
Thanks, Peter.
Thank you. Okay. So moving from there, am I on? It looks all right. There we go. Meditation and trauma. I should have something to say about that. Well, it's a little bit of a paradox here. I think the ultimate therapy, truly, is meditation. It really is cultivating this practice or series of practices, hopefully also involving practices that involve the body, so yoga, tai chi, qigong, things like that, and the practice of stillness. On the other hand, when people begin to meditate, or have been meditating for long periods of time even, you close your eyes, and sooner or later, one of three things are going to happen. Number one, you're going to bang into your trauma and be swallowed into that black hole, which is okay as long as you have some way to work with it. Other thing that happens is you come near your trauma and you dissociate. And I've worked with a number of people, many, many people, who have been in long-term meditation where it was really increasing their dissociation. So how to give tools so we know a little bit of how to navigate these waters when they happen. The other thing that also can happen, well, going into the trauma often brings us to the hell realm. I think some of you are nodding. Or into the beatific realm. And both of those are actually important experiences. They're important archetypal polarities, really. The thing about polarities is they cause the problem where they're either unipolar or if they're polar, where they're not integrated. And so sometimes this is called the bliss bypass. I think you probably know a little bit about that. First time it happens, you say, oh my God, it was worth all this time sitting in this cramped position. And and this is from a tradition in Japan where when a tea bowl is broken, it has cracks, and the cracks are filled with gold. And the meaning here is that in our deepest woundings come our greatest preciousness, our greatest value. And again, so many of all of us not are here to mend our wounds, our traumas and our wounds. And I distinguish between trauma and wounds, although it's not an absolute distinction. But trauma is something like a shock that just happens to us and blasts us in our, out of our bodies, or causes us to collapse in helplessness. Whereas wounds are the things that, when they're chronic, they are traumatic, but they're wounds where a betrayal has been broken. And sometimes it could be something very simple. I remember I was seeing a couple, and the wife was upset because the husband didn't want to eat at the table, or he certainly didn't want to eat at the table if they had a tablecloth. And so if they had friends over, it was a little bit of a problem. So anyhow, within 5 minutes, there was an image of him when he was about 4 years old, and they were visiting some friends, and there was a tablecloth, and he pulled the tablecloth, and things fell off, and of course his parents, they were angry, frightened, angry, and they yelled at him, and that left that impression, that impact on him for decades. So again, there are relatively simple things, but they're not simple, because that kind of betrayal from those who are supposed to nurture us and help us. And when the nurturing becomes habitual, children are geniuses. Young children are geniuses. The way they are able to actually manipulate some of the archetypal dimensions really much, much better than we are. And they invent something where they start to take care of themselves. And I think most of us here can identify in some degree with that kind of a process. The problem is that that protector then becomes our persecutor. And shames us, blames us, follows us, shadows us, wherever we go. So again, meeting that part and being able to transform that part. By the way, I assume, we'll check and see if I'm wrong on this, that you like to have a mixture of didactic and experiential work. Does that seem like a reasonable balance? Yes. Huh? Well, hopefully there will be a little bit more of experiential. I try to blend them together. Usually it works best that way. This is beyond the archetypal splittings, is what happens as people transform trauma. By the way, in somatic experiencing, when people work with their traumas, transform their traumas, very frequently, very, very, very frequently, there's some kind of an opening, a portal opens into what would best be called the spiritual dimension. And that door is not the end. That's an opening. And again, this is where I see trauma work and meditation holding together, because that's something that needs to be cultivated and matured and grown, which is what happens in meditation. So, with trauma, we become fragmented. We become split in many ways. We leave those wounded parts. And how to make that gradual encounter, that re-encounter with those parts, is what I hope to convey. And this is, for me, the experience of flow. This is a source, a return. And I think that people, in deep meditation, come to this state. It's not really a state. This aspect of existence, which is flow, I call coherence, where all the parts of us work together. And that with our breath, there's the involvement of our entire body. Here's another thing I think that comes up. This is more of a developmental piece. We're all caught, neurobiologically wired between the deeply programmed desire to fuse with the other and the inner imperative to separate, to individuate. Often in meditation, one gets the experience of fusing. But then to somehow balance that with that other imperative, which is to individuate, to separate and to individuate, from oneness to separateness, which is a developmental arc we have as fetuses, as infants, and then as toddlers in. So again, how to have that intention in our meditative practices, that to know that both are existing and both in terms of being a full human need to be in balance. And also, right, you've got that one. You know, and it's you know, one of the things that I've often been asked is, does somatic experiencing work for everybody? That's the work that I've developed, I guess. Yeah, and I've thought about that. I've meditated on it, and I realized and it's a really small majority, at least that I have become aware of, is that people who see themselves as victims, or people that know that they have survived and are wanting more to thrive. And when a person is totally wedded to being a victim, then there's no way out, because you have the inner perpetrator, which is that self-care system gone awry, and then you have the victim, and then you have the perpetrator, and the three of them just go together through our lives. And it's again another aspect, another opportunity that we get to, once we come aware of it, to be able to deepen that in meditation. Oh, you don't need to know that. So remind me if I'm having too many. Please, yeah. Yeah. Ah, yeah. So as Jack was saying, how critical embodiment is and how it's been lacking in the psychotherapeutic realm for decades. And I think I know it's really now coming back. The genie's out of the lamp, so to speak. That I think psychotherapy is now recognizing, is needing to recognize, and is somewhat willing to recognize the centrality of the bodily experience, because trauma is a bodily experience. All of our emotions are bodily experiences. We can't change a stuck emotion, a habitual emotion, until we change what's going on in our bodies. I mean, it's that simple. And in trauma, the antidote to trauma is what? is an experience in the body that contradicts those feelings of fear, threat, overwhelming, helplessness, shame, etc. So new experiences, absolutely. So anyhow, this is the old psychology. The analyst is saying to his patient, we'll soon have you sorted out, Mr. Fenton. And you can see, talking is not going to do the trick here. The body is fragmented. Yeah. And this is a painting by René Magritte. He's a Belgian surrealist. Probably I've at least seen some of his paintings. And this is also our society. This is dissociation, of course. It's also our societal disconnection between mind and body. We have here. How many of you suffer or are therapists and work with clients that are suffering from all kinds of physical ailments? Okay, yeah, that's the majority. So fibromyalgia, irritable bowel, chronic fatigue, migraines, so forth. They're very common. And this also is about this split between mind and body. And those split off parts, they do their own thing. They send the signals. But again, they're not where signals would have been helpful. When they become chronic, they become illness. Yes, okay. So let's start at the beginning. When I wrote Unspoken Voice, in an Unspoken Voice, I didn't actually know this quote. Of course, it would have been right on the first page. There is a voice that doesn't use words. Listen. And this is the language of touch, of being touched. Between caregivers and infants. Between, well, what do you think this is? Between, you're right. And between generations. The primacy of touch. Those are what give us our earliest experiences of the world. And again, when we go into meditation, we come to those hidden, those rooms, often walled up rooms, where there was inadequate touch or where there was inappropriate touch. And again, how to work with those. When people wonder, what if I really didn't receive that as an infant, as a child? Is it inappropriate? Is there any hope? And I think a number of you find hope in unusual ways. In synchronicities, perhaps. I think people, when they start to meditate, they become more aware of such coincidences. Carl Jung said, the right way to wholeness is made of fateful detours and wrong turnings. Yeah. Anyhow, there are these archetypes, these holdings, these universals that, don't ask me where they come from. You know, they certainly don't come from our experience in many, our direct autobiographical experiences in many cases, but they exist. And they come when they're needed, once we cultivate a relationship to them. And again, I think that's another thing that meditation helps us to provide, is to be able to access those dimensions, those holdings. You know, the Beatles song, in times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me. In times of trouble, yeah. In times of trouble, Mother Mary comes to me. That's that holding presence. T- touch, the specificity of emotions for touch is five, in many cases, many emotions, is five times greater for touch than it is with facial expression. That's usually how we, that's the gold standard for reading emotion. There's a whole tradition culminating most recently with Paul Ekman's work on the facial, muscular facial expression of emotions. So again, those experiences of being touched in different ways gives us a basic sense of our emotionality. Now this one, yeah. This is this came from a Finnish study. God, it was, it must have been about 10 years ago. No, less, about 8 years ago. Actually, this is something I would do with children 40 years ago. And they would have them color different emotions. And if you don't think that emotions are a bodily experience, this really provides ample evidence. What they did, it looks fancier than it is. It looks like they're in some kind of a special brain scanner or something like that. That's not what this is. They simply asked the people to focus on a particular emotion and then to color where they felt more intense sensations or what kind of sensations, what level of sensations they were feeling in their bodies. And that little thing over the end here, right here, the black is basically, it's just midline, neutral. And then the intensity of the sensation, it goes up to here to 15 or down to minus 15. So in other words, if you lose sensation in a particular part of the body. So you can see anger is particularly in the upper body, very strong in the arms and in the lower face, the jaws. Right, fear has a somewhat similar thing, although there's more intensity in the temple, and there's also lack of sensation in the arms. So you can see the difference between fear and anger isn't all that great. And often when people move from fear to anger, and then, that's never the end result, then to a sense of deeper connection with self, with deep relaxation, with joy. And then you see with disgust very strong around the gut, all the way up into the throat, and also very strong around the mouth. And disgust, of course, is an extension of the urge to, of nausea, the urge to vomit. It probably comes originally from being herd mammals. If one of our co-specifics, one of our colleagues, eats some carrion and then starts wrenching because there's something toxic there, we want everybody, as mammals, we need everybody to experience this nausea right away, so you know, do not eat that. But this is becomes the core emotion that's associated with shame. And again, it's something that's going to come up, has already come up for you so many times in sitting, either being swallowed by it, gripped by it, or leaving it there. But again, you can't do this forever. The more we try to dissociate from our feelings, the more that gap is filled with illness. And then happiness, oh, that's really a nice one. That's where there's an incredibly beautiful, broad sensation in the chest. And again, this is not saying what the sensation is. It really, they need to talk to me about that a little bit more. Happiness is so strong in the chest, really in the face, in the arms, in the legs. When people feel happy, it feels happy all over. So let me tell you how I began, basically, the impetus of my career in working with trauma. And this is an event that happened in 1969. And I was asked to see a woman I called Nancy. I describe her in the books. She was referred to me by a psychiatrist, and she was referred to him by a number of internists and specialists because she was suffering from all kinds of symptoms that you would now call fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue, irritable bowel, migraine, severe PMS, urinary problems, and severe panic attacks and agoraphobia to the degree that she was unable to leave her house without, I mean, even accompanied by her husband. It was an ordeal because she was clinging so much to him, and you could sense in both of them, both his uncomfortableness and her hell that she was living with. So I had actually been doing a study in the mid to later 60s on some somatically based, bodily based relaxation exercises that I had been developing. And so I decided to test this on a group of people who had high blood pressure. And I would get them to relax certain muscles in the neck and jaw. And then sometimes within 20 minutes, the blood pressure would go to from 160, 170, down to 120. So my friend, Ed, psychiatrist, he thought that at least if I could do some of these relaxation exercises with her, that that might at least help with her anxiety. So she came in with her husband. Her pulse was beating at about 140 beats a minute from the, could see it from the carotid pulse. And really not knowing what I was doing at the time. And occasionally from time to time. I tried to get her, I got her to relax these muscles. And as the relaxation progressed, her heart rate went down and down. And I was like, those of you who are therapists, remember the first time, if you work with somebody, you're one of your earliest clients and you're successful, you actually think you know something. Right, and then the rude awakening, of course, you find out it's rather limited. So I was at that point here like, wow, you know, look what I discovered here. However, just as I was thinking those thoughts, her heart rate shot up to about a 108 beats a minute. And I thought, oh my God. So I did... What would be the stupidest thing you could do in a situation like that? That's what I did, believe me. Right? Nancy, relax. You need to relax. Although, her heart rate started coming down. And I was quite relieved. But it kept on going down and down and down to 180, to 80, 70, 60, 50. And something was obviously going wrong here. So she opened her eyes and grabbed onto my eyes. She was pale. Her fingers were blue. And she was breathless. Doctor, I'm dying. I'm dying. Don't let me die. Help me. Help me. Don't let me die. Talk about continually working with one's trauma. Whenever I mention this, I get that very similar feeling in my chest where it empties of sensation. So, without quite knowing why, although my unconscious, my archetypal information was there ready, I said, Nancy, there's a tiger crouched ready to spring. Run, climb those rocks, and escape. And after a while, her legs started to shake and tremble and move as though she were running. I could see her arms were also moving. This went on for about 30 or 40 minutes. There'd be waves where her fingers would be icy cold, her heart rate would be high. Then there would be a spontaneous breath, and the heart rate would settle, the fingers would become more warm. Then there'd be spontaneous breath. You'll be seeing that demonstrated. And this one, went on in cycles. By the end of the session, her body was just evenly warm. Her face was with even color. And she opened her eyes, and this time, instead of grabbing onto mine, we gazed together. And she said, "Do you want to know what happened?" Well, of course I know. This is my method, you know. Why would I not know? But fortunately, I said yes. And she described that when I gave that image, she could see the image. And then as she started to run, her legs felt like lead, like she couldn't run. And with my encouragement, she reported that she could then start to run. And she could feel power and strength coming into her legs. And then as she climbed, she sat above at the ledge and looked down. Instead of seeing the tiger, she saw herself when she was 4 years old, being held by doctors and nurses and the ether mask forced on her face for a tonsillectomy. These were routine. Sometimes if, you know, one child had a routine, they would get all the siblings, the brothers and sisters in and have the... And these were horribly traumatizing. Indeed, around the time in the 70s, when I worked with people with severe panic attacks and anxiety, so many of them had those kind of experiences, very similar experiences. She also reported that she felt like she was being held in warm, tingling waves. And that was the portal. That was the archetype. That was the holding presence that exists for all of us in times of trouble. And what gave me the knowledge that trauma was not a matter of erasing memories, reliving memories, but of transforming these experiences through disciplined, mindful, bodyful, embodied awareness. And I think the beginning of the kind of mindfulness movement was very much a cognitive process. It was much more on, you know, what was going on in the mind and learning to watch our thoughts. And of course, this is important, but it's only a small part of what it takes to transform. And what it takes are working from the bottom up, what I call core regulation. And that means working with our sensations in particular ways, which we will be exploring today. Yeah. This is the other thing here, particularly those of you who are, well, for everyone. You see this enormous iceberg, which sunk the Titanic. And the very tip is what is called, it's a definition, post-traumatic stress disorder. And it has features such as flashbacks, reminders of the traumatic event, hyperarousal, nightmares, hypervigilance, not being able to let down, to relax. And these are so-called positive symptoms. It's not very positive if you're experiencing them, but let's just say they're dramatic. But the major iceberg has to do with what I was talking about before and what you were acknowledging of these physical sensations and high levels of dissociation. Now, they actually have a name for that, but they haven't been able to get it into the DSM-5 as yet. At least I don't think they have. I haven't read. Have they? No. Okay. Yeah, I've stopped reading that book. It's just too damn long. But no, there are important stuff there, seriously. There are important stuff. But anyhow, desnos is disorders of extreme stress not otherwise specified. Don't ask me who thought of that. You know. And this is what I was talking about before. These are these physical manifestations that are not considered trauma in the PTSD sense, but that probably affect more people more deeply than those other kind. And by the way, even the PTSD, when they're chronic, they tend to then lead to dysfunction in the body due to this core dysregulation. All right, so that's that. So what I'm going to show you now, in a way, is all you have to know about trauma. And much of my knowledge, much of my inspiration comes from the study of animals in the wild. Because I realized when I started working with more and more people that many people had symptoms that, remember, the trauma was not in the lexicon at the time. This was in the early 70s. It wasn't until 11 or 12 years that it would be entombed in the DSM-3 as a billable disorder. Well, that's one of the main reasons we have that book. Those of you who know that. So it occurred to me that, again, people were so easily affected, deleteriously traumatized, and as so were suffering in their life, and particularly were very limited in the capacity to be in the here and now. That's another important thing in meditation. And that is being able to go into very deep places when you've been meditating for a while. Very deep places. It's really essential that when we come back, we're able to reorient. That we're able to become connected with our here and now experience and with others. Not necessarily with a lot of talk, but with the sense of connection. Remember, again, the oneness that comes in the internal experience from the and the desire for connection. It was also the desire to be in our own bodies, our own selves. So anyhow, it occurred to me, animals in the wild are threatened, prey animals in the wild, that is to say, generally animals that have eyes off to their sides. Prey animals tend to be preyed upon routinely, and if they escape, you live. If you don't escape and you're eaten, you die. But there's no room for in between. So, in other words, if an animal had the same kinds of behavioral and some somatic symptoms that we do, the next encounter, it would be much less likely to escape, and then the next, less and less likely. And the animals wouldn't survive, nor would the species survive. And so we know that except for our meddling, generally animal species tend to survive. Indeed, they tend to thrive within their own ecological niche, and even outside of their own ecologicalness. They're able to make adaption. So what was the difference between animals who, I reason, couldn't, at least animals in the wild, I'm not talking about pets. You can probably traumatize your pet goldfish even. Well, no, you can't actually. But animals in the wild, what gives them that relative immunity to not become traumatized? Something must be going on, and that something, coupled with the neurobiological understandings, gave me the clues of what it takes for us to not become traumatized and to do what animals do naturally at the time, to do that, so to speak, retroactively. So let's look at this video together here. Oop. And while you're watching it, be aware as much as you can of your bodily sensations as you watch it. Also, keep in mind that this encounter is going on at 140 kilometers an hour, 60, 65 miles an hour, sometimes even greater. And it's this life or death sprint, both for the cheetah, as you'll see, and the impala. Because if the cheetah doesn't make a kill, that her cub, at least one in six attempts, her cubs then will not survive. They'll die. And so, again, we know that the cheetah is an endangered species, so keeping that in mind. Oh, it says air parrot, too. Oh. Ew. Well, let's give it a try. Let's just try and see what happens. Yeah. Yeah, no, we're okay. I'm getting to work with all my traumas now, my residuals. Okay. And again, I think that's what meditation provides to us. Those people who have worked on their own traumas, it's really a way of doing many things, but also revisiting little aspects of it that we might, well, certainly that we will have missed. Yeah?
She dashes forward.
65 miles an hour. Oh. Well, let's just at break. Yeah.
This time, Duma has killed a good-sized female impala. Unfortunately, in the plane, one's own gratification often stimulates another's envy. Duma's catch has been witnessed from start to finish. The spy is Mama Kingua, a spotted hyena. She knows that Duma is completely exhausted by her final sprint.
Yeah, for that 65-mile-an-hour sprint, the cheetah is useless.
And yet, things may not finish as we thought they would.
And notice the stiffening and the collapse.
The weak are capable of cunning trickery.
And being aware of those sensations. Yeah. Well, and that's the applause we have for ourselves, really. There's a few things here to dissect. And again, this is what I was talking about before, about how animals in the wild can't afford to be traumatized. It's evolutionarily unsustainable. So again, there have to be robust mechanisms built in that take us out of this trauma state. Now, this is one of my, from the non-living world, this is possibly my best friend here. Yeah. It's, you know, this slinky. Yeah, let me stand up so you can maybe see a little bit better here. So, here's the impala grazing on their afternoon repast in this upland savanna. And then the cheetah springs and the impala moves into action, expending maximum energy. Then in that moment, when the cheetah grabs the impala, or even before, I have some video material where you see the impala collapsing before, just at the second before contact is made. So all of this energy, then it doesn't disappear. You know, when you see the gazelle running, the impala running at, 65 miles an hour, and then it's not moving at all that energy is still there. It didn't disappear. So, but instead of being like this, it's like that. It's locked in. That's the essence of trauma, is this compressed energy. And like with Nancy, I was discovering that my clients would sometimes have symptoms of hyperarousal, like the high heart rate with Nancy, or shutdown. And so the key was in helping the person move from those states towards equilibrium. We're going to get more into that, and you'll be doing some little exercise around that as well. So here's the thing you don't want to do. And if therapies are doing this, I just suggest you go in the other direction here. If you remove this inhibition all of a sudden, then this same energy, as you saw, the gazelle just, impala just took off. That same energy gets be released and becomes the mobilization that lets the impala escape. Now, so that energy then went right into action. What happens in trauma is because action is prevented, there's nowhere for that energy to go. Let's just say it's all dressed up, but with nowhere to go. So again, if you release this energy prematurely, it's going to wildly explode. And this is akin to when people relive their traumatic memories. And there are therapies that that literally get people to relive their traumas over and over and over. And the results of this are beyond belief. I mean, some people will get, if it's a relatively recent trauma and there's not a lot of early trauma, you can do almost anything and people will get better. I mean, they get better on their own. But if it's with people who have a lot of trauma, this reliving is no use because it's, again, like just wildly expanding this energy, and where it lands, no one really knows. The key here, and this is the key, is to let this energy release one small amount at a time, to revisit the trauma one small amount at a time. I call this titration. So what happens energetically, we release the energy and it vibrates and comes to equilibrium. Then we release more energy, it vibrates and comes to equilibrium. More energy and it vibrates and comes to equilibrium. I think this is also really important in terms of meditation, is that when you begin meditation, I think it's really important to do it only a small amount at a time and then reorient and gradually, because, you know, meditation is a kind of exercise It's a kind of neural exercise. And, you know, I think you all know, specific areas of the brain light up with experienced meditators. So it is a reorganization of the brain. But again, I think for safety, it makes sense to just learn to some awareness focusing techniques and to do those and then to gradually increase one's level of meditation. The other trick here, this is one of my next favorite toys. I was flying back to Denver one day, I think it was like in 1991, and it was a little later than that because it was a new airport. Yeah, so it was about 95. Anyhow, they had one of these science stores, and I went in and I saw this thing on a shelf, and I said, whoa. So I pulled it down, and I said, like this. So, I mean, I didn't say anything. I just asked the store owner, how many do you have? So they had a dozen, but bigger ones, much bigger ones. They're bigger than this. And so I had to go next door and buy a suitcase to put them all in the suitcase. And what this illustrates is that when people first become in contact with their bodily experience, the contraction, which is trauma, feels worse. So that the contraction increases. I'm sure that most all of you have experienced something like this. The first time you go in, oh yeah, there's a good reason for not being wanting to be with my body, because it doesn't feel good. And so, but anyhow, when you're able to actually move into this contraction in a titrated way, remember the slinky, and then expand, and then contract, and then expand further, and contract, and then expand further. And this, again, is the expansion we experience in trauma transformation and in meditation. Okay, are we doing on time? No. Maybe I take a little time if some of you have questions, and then we'll get a good stretch and a break. Yes, and you're going to have to yell. I don't know if there is a microphone here and there. Yes, there are two mics, so please go for it.
Hi, can you hear me? Perfect. So I'm a dance therapist, and I'm wondering what you think the role is, because I think in trauma a lot of times you're unable to move and unable to get out of the situation. So I'm wondering what the role of movement might be.
The role of what?
Movement.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. Movement really fits in with this kind of stuff in a very important way in trauma therapy, for sure. I think what sometimes happens, though, which is not helpful, I'm sure not with you, is that the therapist will try to get the person to move. But when you're in the immobility state, we'll be exploring more about that, you cannot move. You feel paralyzed. I mean, you can, but you have to will it. But then the movement isn't authentic anymore, and the therapist, a movement therapist, will be able to see that, will be able to notice that. So the key is in that contraction to find the beginning of the smallest impulse towards moving, and then to gradually expand that impulse into outer movement. Okay. Over here, probably best to go to the microphone. It's behind you. And maybe we get some mic runners.
I'm wondering what the difference, I mean, I know we're not animals, but what makes us become stuck in that trauma as opposed to an animal?
Yeah, well, you stole my line. That's exactly. What is it that keeps us stuck in the trauma? It's really very simple. It's our fear of the sensations that occur as we're moving out of trauma. Our fear of the sensations, so what do? We brace against the sensations. What happens then? The sensations seem even greater. So we brace even more. So here are the sensations that move us. Remember, they're sensations of high activation, of high arousal. So they start to come out of the blue and we stop them. We suppress them. But you know, there's an expression, that which we resist persists. It sounds like an AA saying. I'm not sure where it comes from. Is it? So anyhow, so what we do is we push against it, and then it seems to push even more. And then we push down as much as we can, and it's pushing up. And then we think, oh my God, if we ever let this happen, it'll completely overwhelm us. So, but these are the very sensations that take us through the states of compression into states of activation, into sense of peace, goodness, relaxation.
Sorry, I have a follow-up question. Can we all be Nancy in the way that she would, that she released that trauma, and also... Sorry.
No, you actually... Thank you for reminding me. After that, after my session with... There's a little gap here. After my session with Nancy, first of all, I realized where the image came from. I was taking a graduate seminar in ethology, study of animals in the wild. And one of the professors, I think we would meet for lunch every week or two, he mentioned this phenomenon of immobility. If you take an animal and you restrain it, it goes into an immobility state. Its heart rate goes down. It stays there usually for seconds to a minute or so and then comes back out. And that gave me the hint of what was going on with Nancy. I also realized that I could have easily re-traumatized her. Again, the word trauma wasn't used then, so I could have easily overwhelmed her. And what would have happened if I had not had that image? So clearly this wasn't going to work as a trauma therapy, because it was, well, it was the kind of therapy that I was saying you shouldn't be doing. So that's where I started to develop the idea of titration and progressive exposure to those traumatic symptoms, but primarily to the sensations that are taking the person out of the trauma. So it's a gradual, I don't know, even like to call it exposure, it's a gradual befriending of those sensations that lead us back. Yeah.
Hi. I think you're starting to speak a bit to the question I have, but I wanted a distinction maybe between a holding environment and the importance of touch and a person being with you. So I'm an old meditator, and I came into meditation like a lot of people with, I had no therapy, mm-hmm. and I went into solitary retreat and flooded, right?
Yeah.
Not unfamiliar. My teacher's very traditional Tibetan Buddhist instruction at the time was to pray to Tara, the goddess mm-hmm. of compassion. It wasn't enough for me.
No, that's right. Yeah. And again, you're pointing to, the evolution that's going on exactly. in mindfulness and meditation is knowing how important it is to bring in the body. Let me tell you, my first experience in 1965, I had come out to the West Coast, 64, to go to graduate school at Berkeley. And by the way, these are my old stomping grounds up here. I had a cabin up in Bodega Bay, you know. So it's kind of like a reunion coming here, really. And so, oh yes. So, my friend Jack, are you here, Jack Kaplan? No, okay, I thought he was going to be here. So anyhow, I had a friend, and he This was during the free speech movement, and when people were, were blocking Sproul Hall, and they wouldn't let anybody in, and people had jobs there, and I just didn't feel that this was right. So I'd help this one person get in. Well, anyhow, we became friends, and he was a meditator at Green Gulch, in the center in San Francisco. And there was a workshop being given by Charlotte Selvers for the monks who were there, and she and her husband Charles Brooks would have us walk around. I mean, really, for 2 days here, and feel our feet. What? Feel how our arms move. Pick up a stone. Feel how much it weighed. Feel its textures, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I remember walking around once and catching the eye of one of the monks, and I said something like, "How was this for you?" And he went, "Have big headache." So it was indeed a challenge. Then at the end, she had us lay down and feel our breath, I think, coming in through our groin and then up into our torso and in from our feet, breathing in up to our heads. I was a scientist, I was doing my graduate. He said, "Your breath doesn't come in your feet." However, when we left, and that was that church on the top of the hill, that modern church, I think it's on Geary Street. Yeah, what's it called? Grace Cathedral. We walked out of the door and looked down into the valley. The sun was setting and the city lights were on. And it's like, oh my God, this is the most beautiful thing I've ever seen. So that began my exploration. But the key here is in also doing meditation, movement meditation. The movement person also talked about that, really as a way to what I call strengthen the body ego. And it's like developing certain skills, but skills where we know that we have some kind of a home. And as you say, praying for the divine intervention sometimes helps. But where there's trauma, early trauma especially, we really need to mix this up with embodiment. And my experience over a few years is that when we really are able to get embodied experience, that's when those archetypes come to us. Because they're there waiting, really. And I think that's what so many, I think all religions really are about that, about reminders of how to connect to that. And often, I think about, for example, the Sufi, the dervishes. This is so much about movement. Using movement for spiritual awakening. Yeah. One more over here.
Hi.
Hello.
I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner.
Mm-hmm.
And so
maybe hold it closer so people can hear better.
I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner, and I'm called upon a lot to prescribe medications for psychiatric issues, including trauma. And most of my patients have comorbid conditions and trauma underlying.
Sure.
My sense is that a lot of the medications we use actually dampen or prevent people from feeling the trauma, the feelings that they need to be.
Sure, there's no question about that. These drugs were invented basically, to control behaviors so it'd be easier for the staff. But they also have, in some cases, they really have allowed people to function where they couldn't function before. You know, when I work with people who are, you know, when I started working, there were only three medications available, if you can imagine that. And I did discover that people who are, especially who are on tranquilizers, benzos now, the benzodiazepines, that's really can be problematic, but you just can't take people off them. You have to give them, build up the tools that they can use as they gradually wean from the medications. And again, you know, the funding of mental health, community mental health, is so piss poor here. You know, all of this talk with the opioid, oh yes, yeah, or people shooting guns. It's not the guns. Well, yeah, I guess you can run over somebody with a car. But it's about people who are mentally ill. But what's being done about that? Nothing. Squat. I've done some pro bono work for some of the community mental health. And you know this. You're overworked, understaffed. The staff are usually very young interns that were very learning. Very challenging client load, patient load. You know, so that has to change. And really what's at this root of this, it's not genetics. Genetics play a role. It's trauma. So, yeah. Okay. One here. Oh, there you go. You can.
It's maybe something you'll get into later, but I'm thinking about the age at which the trauma occurs, the type of it, the intensity, and, you know, how that kind of spreads through your body. Is that if something happens to you earlier, is that harder to get to? That kind
yes.
of.
Well, yeah. When things, the earlier things happen, the less context there is. So, you know, if a fetus is exposed to threat in terms of compromise, oxygen compromise, it has no experience to compare that to. So it becomes part of one's organism. But of course it's not, because there was an organism before that. What happens in early, early infancy, what happens, for example, with our attachments with the caregivers is crucial. But we don't remember that. Of course not. But we do remember it procedurally. I'll be talking a little more about this at the end. And procedural memories are the body memories, are the patterns of behavior. For example, with attachment, we find ourselves being strangely attracted to certain people or repelled by others. What's that about? That's not just a random occurrence. That in most cases, it involves earlier sensitizations. So when you're working with a person, you, again, in many different ways, in including the kinds of body awareness I was talking about, all of those things really allow us to begin to make a contextual framework to be able to organize those early experiences and make sense of them. I think there was somebody else. Yeah. Oh, two and two. There's a very inquisitive audience, yes.
I work in eating disorders treatment, and increasingly in big hospitals like Stanford and HMOs are very fond of using exposure treatments for things like anorexia. And now I heard a lecture from a treatment provider at Stanford this week who said instead of using a hierarchy where they would expose them to the less feared thing first, they exposed them to the most feared thing first. And I said, why? And she said, because when there's a strong emotional response, in this case, terror, it causes a faster change in their abandoning their feared object. And so then I receive clients from those programs who are extremely traumatized, but they don't have that particular fear of eating the hot fudge sundae they were forced to eat 10 times.
Right.
And so I'm just wondering.
Yeah. No, I think you really nailed it. Yeah, yeah. With those kind of things, you can cut a specific phobia. But you're not talking about a person who has a person is an a specific phobia. And that's the other thing I find really objectionable in those kinds of therapies, because it treats the person as though they are their trauma.
They don't even talk to them.
Wow. Well, hey, you know, I remember this is the way it was in the 70s. They would tie Vietnam vets down to a chair and make them watch movies like Platoon over and over again. The idea was draining the swamps. It's kind of a Freudian hydraulic model. And I'm just so deeply disturbed when especially institutions like this are doing things like this. I mean, look, I can see it because you don't need any training. Basically, you don't need any training. You know, in the somatic experiencing, it's a 3-year training program. So I understand that, you know, the way things, mental health works, that's not something. But even if they have some tools about that to temper this, anyhow, it gets me dizzy. Truly gets me dizzy. Okay, gotcha.
I am a director of a crisis stabilization clinic for individuals that are developmentally disabled with co-occurring mental health issues.
Yeah.
I train sheriffs and first responders on how to respond if someone's autistic having a meltdown.
Oh, great.
Most of what I'm doing is embodiment because you can't use cognition, you can't use words, because people are getting flooded and overwhelmed in an arousal state where they can't process information. My question to you, though, and for SE, for working with people who are not neurotypical or development disabled, autism, there's a lot of disconnection with the body awareness to begin with.
Sure.
So I'm curious what the applicability is.
But, you know, you can do something. Mm-hmm. You know, I was just reminded of this a little while ago. A friend of mine, a very good friend of Mayor Garcetti, mayor of Los Angeles. And so I was working with some of his people because they're really devoting efforts to work with people who are being trafficked, sex trafficked. And, I mean, these people are horrendously abused. Many of them have had childhood traumas, and they are continually re-traumatizing this. And they're terrified. And sometimes they find these people locked in containers. I mean, it's horrible. So at that meeting, a number of mental health people were there, including some of the sheriff's people. And I said, look, the sheriff people, you're the ones that can make the biggest impact on this person's life. Because when you see them there, if you just say, hi, I'm so-and-so, and I'm here to protect you, we're going to find you a safe place to be. I mean, you have to have something that is relatively safe or considerably less dangerous than that. So right there, in other words, it's not the words. Oh, the words, but it's the words, we are going to protect you, we are going to help keep you safe. And that's what we hope every child learns from their parents, but they don't all learn that.
Just to say, I have to tell sheriffs to put their shoulders back, have soft cheeks. I have to operationalize the stance that they approach somebody in very physically with very few words so that the somatic expression is calm and safe because they're trying to differentiate when somebody's assaulting them from a gang member fronting them off from someone dysregulated.
Yeah, I know. I mean, this is the 800-pound gorilla here, you know, in all of these things. I mean, the training needs to be more embodied training. It really does. Yeah. Because if the police don't learn to attend to their own body sensations, they're not going to be able to find that calmer place. I mean, remember, this is a difficult job. I mean, I really sympathize with that. I mean, somebody could always turn, you know, they go to domestic violence reports. A lot of policemen get killed. They open the door, and usually the husband is there and shoots them. So, you know, but, you know, it's an interesting thing about this. A couple of my students were Navy SEALs, actually, and they were using SE, incorporating it into their training. And so they've been trying for years to get me to go and to do experience their shooting. It's kind of like a zen of archery, but with rifles. And it was astonishing. I mean, truly astonishing. It was target practice. And first you get something at 50 feet with a small gun like a 22, and then you work up to something like one of these assault weapons, and the targets are like literally this big, and they're 600 yards, six football fields away. And ping, 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 we got him. And then over on the side were the sheriff's people, and they were hooting it up and, you know, yelling. And so I just kind of went over there and watched, and they were missing all the targets. So I'm not saying we should all learn how to use guns, but this is part of what needs to be in the training so that they can know what to say, how to say it, and when there really absolutely has to be a shoot. So again, this kind of training is, I've heard of some of the police forces are actually bringing in mindfulness training. So you know what to do, and you know how to talk people down, especially mental ill people down. But again, with a similar thing, we're not here to harm you. But we're police, and you need to get down on the ground. This kind of a thing. Excuse me. Yeah, I mean, there's no way or anywhere in the world that mindfulness, embodied mindfulness particularly, isn't necessary.
You were talking earlier about the suppression of the activation energy.
Can we get some of the little honey in there? Oh, is that? Yep, sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. You were talking... I'll hold it like a rock star. Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
You were talking
or an ice cream cone.
about the suppression of that activation energy that that you referenced with the Impala and otherwise. Do you think there's a socialized element to that in humans? Why do you think it's different in human beings?
What's different?
The release of the activation energy.
Well, I don't really know, but I'm going to show you a trailer at the end of the day which kind of looks at that. But... you know, part of it is we outthink ourselves, and we still have this feeling that these deep primordial sensations are animal, are bad, and so we don't want to deal with them. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a big part of it, and we override them with our frontal brains. But you can override them. But you can't keep them from pressing up.
So then how would you respond to the technique to get the prefrontal cortex online in trauma recovery?
Well, again, that comes from gradually visiting those sensations while the frontal parts are in brain. So a lot of the cognitive thing and a lot of the meditation was to train the prefrontal cortex. And, you know, amazing things, like not only there's more activity, but you're actually changing the structural anatomy of those parts of the brain with the, you know, long-term meditators. That's really pretty interesting. But I think the key here in trauma work is to be able not just to light up the prefrontal cortex, but to light it up at the same time as you're sensing these primal sensations and these difficult feelings and emotions, sort of holding them together.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Okay, boy. Okay. I don't know what time it is. You know, I'll take a couple of more questions now, then let's break because we're sitting in too long and we're going to be experiencing tonic immobility.
Hi. I'm a nurse, been a nurse for over 30 years.
Wow.
And have also been in leadership positions for other healthcare providers and have been very concerned about how we help our healers, our first responders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I recently had an amazing opportunity to spend a day with a very experienced shaman who was talking to me about, in trauma, it's as if a piece of you dies, which I've seen in patients and in healthcare providers and all of us who have witnessed people in such great pain.
Yeah.
And she was talking to me about soul retrieval, and and I was really touched by that because I was thinking about us who witness this, and oftentimes we have a very definitive amount of time that we can be with this person.
Yeah.
And how do we put them together? And how do we put ourselves together after seeing such great pain?
You know, it's interesting because a lot of nurses are seem to be attracted to the mindfulness meditation. And it's, I think it's because they're on the front line. You have a short period of time. Go over the question, the basic question again.
The basic question is, how do we help healthcare providers with the pain? And when the healthcare provider or any of us who are helping people, how do we help those people in a short amount of period to bring their pieces back together?
Yeah. You know, again, if these are people who haven't had a lot of early trauma, you can often, you know, do an intervention where you just basically bring them to... You were talking about soul retrieval, that's right. Well, what we're doing here is more like soul retrieval than it is like psychotherapy. But there's a big difference. One big difference is in soul retrieval, traditionally in soul retrieval, the person who is the shaman, he ventures out into the other world where the soul of the person has gone, has left the body. And he, usually through chanting and incantations and so forth, seduces that soul back into the body. You know, but what is really going on here? You're talking about something happens like that. We're out of our body. It's dissociation instead of soul loss. I think soul loss is more accurate, quite frankly. It's more definitely more descriptive. But instead of the shaman calling the soul, I mean, if you're a shaman and can do it, if you're really a shaman, but not many people are really shamans. If you're a shaman and you can really do that, well, that's great. But what we have to do is help the client journey to where their soul has been lost, to the dissociated parts, and to bring them back together in the body. So I think if you can do just some very simple things, we'll be doing exercises. The rest of the day we'll be doing a lot of different exercises to help bring them back into their bodies. Just that can make such a difference. And you know, nurses, for example, and people in emergency rooms. One of my students, he was the chief ER doctor at Napa. I think it's Napa Community. And he and one of the other SE students were trying to do some programs for people who were in the emergency room. And it made a tremendous, tremendous difference because there's a situation where you are constantly in high activation and you don't get let down time. And people die. Stuff like that happens. Children die, you know. It's difficult, really difficult work. And so he was helping them just take a few moments, you know, when something like that happened. And I did a short study with a group of paramedics, first responders, and we did a 1-day workshop, maybe even a half day workshop, and they followed that group of people. They put them on the same shift, and they had in a two-month period, 24% less mortality of the people who were trained in these simple exercises. And in my book, In an Unspoken Voice, I describe what happens when I got hit by a car and was thrown up into the air and was out of my body, for sure. Yeah. Okay. So. Oh, yeah. Okay, one more, but only one more.
So, one question. I went to a kind of a workshop for healthcare providers, and part of this was holistic medicine. So, basically, the instruction was to shake, like, for 5 minutes. They were talking about trauma. They said, shake for 5 minutes and then dance, you know. So then I'm a dancer. I love that. So I went home and I started to try. I said, and do this with yourself before you ask your clients to do that. So then my question for you is, I started to do some of the shaking in the morning, right, before going to work, and some dancing in the morning, like total of, I don't know, maybe 8-10 minutes total, like okay. 5 and 5. And first I was quite lively. And then one day I did it longer, and I noticed I got nauseated.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, oh, this is really interesting. Yeah. And then... you know, whether this is a medical thing or something else, what I started to notice, it was just feeling extremely tired. Mm-hmm. And then eventually I thought, I think I'm depressed, but I have had no trigger at all.
Yeah.
Right? And then I noticed, oh, yoga really helps. Mm-hmm. And I went to the physician. Everything, all work sure. was negative. You know, so yeah. I'm just kind of curious.
Yeah.
To hear how just standing,
yeah.
and I have yeah. a trampoline, so shaking. Mm-hmm. How does that?
Yeah, actually, there's a trampoline that I use very often. It's a very special trampoline. It's called a Bellicon, and you get a relationship with it. So that those inner movements really do make a difference. Now, I'm not sure what kind of shaking you were doing, but.
Just by standing up on a trampoline or on the floor and just doing
this. Oh, just doing this.
5 minutes. Yeah.
Well, you know, again, what you're doing is you're doing some kind of... Is that the shaking part?
Yeah, yeah.
So they have you go on a trampoline.
Just, or just stand on the floor.
And go like this. Well, you're stressing muscles out. Down. You're stressing. And then they'll eventually will release. But that's different than coming from the inside. You know, and there are a number of things like this. This is some kind of exercise where you get in stress positions, bioenergetic positions, and get shaking and trembling. And again, for somebody who has not had early trauma, has a single event trauma, as I say, you can do almost anything to help bring back into the body. And that certainly can be helpful. But I think the key, for example, if, you know, we were doing a session, is when you would get to the nausea, we would just follow that enough to see how it changes. So, anyhow, let's get a stretch here. Oh, yes. Yes, good. See you in about 15 minutes.